Okay, the first matter we have on calendar today is docket number 63833, Montag v. Venetian. Mr. Greenberg, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
May it please the Court, I am Leon Greenberg, and I am arguing today on behalf of the appellant. I'm requesting that the Court allow me to reserve 5 minutes of my time to rebuttal. The District Court in this case, relying upon the summary judgment standard of Rule 56, dismissed the appellant's third-party beneficiary claim prior to respondent answering this case and without allowing any discovery to be conducted in this case. It held, and I quote, "In reviewing the evidence presented, however, there was no contract showing there was some promise or intent by defendant Venetian and or its customers to directly benefit plaintiff Montag." The District Court cited no precedent for arriving at that holding. It did not explain in its decision how it could decide that there was no material issue of fact in respect to whether Montag was an intended beneficiary of any contract between the Venetian and its customers. Nor did the District Court explain why Montag was not entitled to conduct discovery so she could present to the District Court evidence on the nature of those contracts and that would support her claim she was an intended beneficiary of those contracts.
And there was a 56F application, correct?
Well, Your Honor, the request was made via the opposition raising the point that Montag needed this discovery and was entitled to it under this court's precedence. There was no formal counter-motion presented to the court below. This court...
Why not? Why didn't you do that?
Your Honor, I have to confess I don't know why it was not done. I don't want to mislead the court. The issue was raised, as was submitted to the district court below, there was, in fact, material issues that were clear based upon the record before the court.
That's the purpose of a 56F application with supporting affidavits indicating what potentially are the material questions of fact that you want to explore.
Well, Your Honor, there was a declaration from Ms. Montag that was submitted that explained what she was required to do in respect to serving the customers of the Venetian.
What about, what would you have done in the 56F? What were you looking for? Lay it out for us as if we're the trial court.
Well, the point, Your Honor, is that to determine whether there is an intended beneficiary of a contract, as this court held in the Canafora case, you need to examine all the circumstances surrounding the formation of the contract, as well as what the intent of the parties are to the contract. We have nothing in the record here in respect to any of that. We have not even all of the contracts that were necessarily entered into between the Venetian and the customers.
But given that argument, doesn't that make it incumbent upon you to make that application and say, wait, there's all kinds of questions of material fact here. There's this and this and this and this and this and this and this, and we need time to do discovery on these particular issues.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that this was adequately and appropriately addressed to the district court. We had, in fact, no answer, no ability to even conduct discovery in this case. This court has repeatedly ruled that you must give the plaintiff, assuming the sufficiency of the complaint, and the district court did not disagree that the third-party beneficiary allegations pleaded a claim. It simply found under Rule 56, it reached all of these conclusions, that there was, in fact, no material issue of fact. That is, of course, the standard under Rule 56. I would submit, under this court's jurisprudence, and just as a matter of judicial economy, in that situation, if the issue was presented to the court below, as it was in this case, the presence or absence of a formal procedural counter-motion under 56F. I mean, 56F was discussed in the opposition, and the district court was advised that discovery should be allowed. But no, that application was not made formally by a separate filing, a separate request to the district court procedurally. But I would submit that it would be a miscarriage of justice for the court to rest and affirm the district court's decision on that basis under these circumstances, where, again, we've had no answer, we've had no opportunity to conduct discovery whatsoever. And it was improper on its face for the district court to make these findings regarding the absence of any third-party beneficiary right here when there was no record before the court as to what the intent of the parties were or even what the contracts necessarily were between the Venetian and its customers. And there are conflicting contracts. We have a contract that is from 2009 that was submitted by the plaintiff, a banquet order form that contains no waiver or express disclaimer of a third-party beneficiary right or creation of any third-party beneficiary rights. Venetian introduced a 2012 banquet contract document that disclaimed those rights. So we don't even know actually what contracts were applicable during the time period at issue here. In addition, I would submit that the charge slip that was submitted for the room service functions in and of itself is sufficient to raise an issue of material fact. This is in the record of Appendix 165, and this is discussed in my brief at page 16. This document, which Montag affirmed to the district court, she had to get the customers to sign when she brought them the room service, says 18% service charge underneath in big letters, gratuity included. And then underneath it has a line that says additional gratuity. So what was the customer led to believe?
Did you provide anything to explain what those specific terms of art meant? Was it merely something that was being charged by the hotel for the benefit of the hotel property? How was one to interpret that?
This is what discovery is needed for. How was that understood? Fundamentally, as a matter of law, I would submit that this is misleading and does create an expectancy by the customer.
That's part of the problem. You're assuming it's an expectancy. The question under 12b-5, and even when you morph it over into kind of a summary judgment.
Your Honor, the Venetian was free to simply raise the prices they were charging by 18% if they wished to. That's the fundamental problem here with what happened, and that's why we need to have a further record in terms of
what
the customer understood.
But you're saying that it was raised for your client as intended, but there's nothing there that says it was for the benefit of the workers.
Your Honor,
You're asking us to assume?
No. In fact, the case laws are very clear that whether someone is an intended beneficiary of a third-party contract is almost always an issue of fact.
Well, it may be an issue of fact if you can clearly show there's a contract, but let's go back into what was being raised previously. We talked about this 56F. Did you argue the specificity of your need to obtain that additional information to the court during the hearing?
Your Honor, it was argued to the court. It was in the briefs to the district court. I cannot recall specifically what was presented on oral argument. I rest on whatever was in my briefs, Your Honor.
Well, Counsel, I would hope this day as you stand before us, you remember what you argued to the court, because that's part of why we asked for oral argument today, for clarified points that we're concerned with. So if inability to explain to us, I hope you did not have inability to explain to the district court likewise, because that may be part of the reason they ruled against you.
Well, Justice Douglas, I understand your concern, and I am, of course, never wish to mislead this court or state things that are not accurate or that I can't be sure are correct, Your Honor.
Something troubling is, at least for me, I don't know about my colleagues, but in the conclusions of law, specifically in her findings, she goes through and under subsection 3, indicating that the proof must be construed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, but that party bears the burden to do more than simply show that there's some metaphysical doubt as the operative facts in order to avoid summary judgment being entered in favor of the moving party. And, of course, cites Mishuta. And then it goes on, the non-moving party must, by affidavit or otherwise, set forth specific facts demonstrating the existence of a general issue for the trial or have summary judgment entered against them, and citing Bulbin. And so she very specifically indicated that essentially he didn't present an affidavit by way of affidavit or anything, the material facts that would avoid summary judgment being entered against you.
Your Honor, we have in the record the service charge slip that I pointed out. It indicates the in-room dining slip. This is something the customer must sign to receive the order. It recites the service charges being charged. It says a gratuity is included. We have the declaration of Ms. Montag in the record saying she had to orally instruct the customer that the gratuity was included in the charge they were paying when they signed this contract. I submit that that is sufficient in the record to raise an issue of material fact. Again, it is the intention of the parties. What was the intention of the customer? What was the understanding of the customer?
What is the standard of review for that particular issue?
Your Honor, if the court does not believe that this documentary evidence raises an issue of fact, then I guess the court's going to have to affirm the lower court. My position, Your Honor, is that the case law is clear that we must examine what the intent of the parties were to see if a third-party beneficiary relationship was created.
You're now into a whole different concept of beyond summary judgment. I don't know that that's part of the summary judgment jurisprudence. To me, it's far more simple. And it was set forth very clearly and specifically by the district court judge. And so that's kind of what I wanted you to address. What did you present? And was there any motion for reconsideration? Was there any testing of her findings in that regard?
No, Your Honor, and not to avoid your line of questioning, I do just want to take a brief time to point out that there are other claims in this case. There is a claim for tortious interference with prospective economic advantage, which was disposed of by the district court. Straight on the matter of law, which is clearly incorrect, the district court held there must be a future prospective contractual relationship to state such a claim for tortious interference. This is not the law. This is not what this court stated in its prior decision, which is cited in my briefs, and it is not the jurisprudence that is recited in the restatement or in every other jurisdiction. An expectancy of an economically beneficial relationship that does not amount to a contract, which in this case is the custom and the expectancy that the plaintiff enjoyed of receiving the tips from the customers, if that was tortiously interfered with, you have a claim. I mean, she has to prove it, of course, but I'm just pointing out to this court that there was a fundamental error of law that was committed by the district court in applying that standard to the pleading. I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Mr. Justices, excuse me, may it please the court, Deanna Forbush appearing on behalf of the Venetian this morning. Just a brief summary of something that you all already know, having lived here as long as you all have. There's a long-standing practice in our industry, in the hospitality industry, of the house charging a service charge on a litany of services. This can range from convention center services, setting up, tearing down convention booths, providing information technology, providing food and beverage services, like banquet and in-suite dining services that are issued in this case, manual labor. you know, the industry charges a service fee on all these services that it provides. In this case, the appellant contends that she's entitled to 100% of the service fees that the hotel charges its customers on the food and beverage it charges pursuant to its banquet contracts and that it delivers to the rooms via the in-suite dining. And she contends that she's entitled to it because they, and only they are entitled to it because they actually serve the food. So the person that places the order, that picks up the phone and takes the order, nobody else involved in the delivery of these services is entitled to any of that, just the people that deliver the food.
Do you know how the breakdown is on that?
Yes.
What is the breakdown?
It's been briefed, but in the in-suite dining, 100% goes to the in-suite dining employees. Now, it's mostly to the servers, but there's about 15% that goes to the dispatch employees. These are the ones that answer the phone, take the orders. On the banquet side, I think about 80% goes to the actual servers, and then there's a small percentage that I think about just roughly, it's in the briefs, I think, but 10% goes to the management, the people scheduling and keeping the wheels on the bus and making sure they can do breakfast, lunch, and dinner with the same crew of people. And so they're completely involved in providing the services, but they don't deliver the plates of food. And then 10% is the house routines on the banquet side. In suite dining side, 100% goes to the service employees. But that includes the dispatch employees.
If we can go backwards for a moment, counsel raised a point, a fundamental point, that they were entitled to some additional discovery pursuant to the 56F motion.
Okay.
Would you like to respond to that? Because it's kind of hard for us to understand why they were not given this opportunity to at least do some limited discovery as to issues. So if you would attempt to clarify in light of what was offered.
Well, yeah, to start with, there was no 56F discovery process. I mean motion practice. I mean, there was not any kind of a big deal. I don't remember this being any kind of a big issue, you know, in the district.
Well, we have a situation, we have a complaint, we have no answer. Now we have a motion to dismiss. It's been morphed over into a motion for summary judgment because of additional facts being alleged. Why is not, at that early stage, some kind of discovery appropriate?
Because there was just nothing but speculation and mere conjecture and conclusory statements with nothing, no basis in fact or reason at all in the complaint. And, you know, to make out a cause of action for this third-party beneficiary, the plaintiff would have to show that they are clearly the manifested intended beneficiary of that agreement. And there was no agreement shown in in-suite dining. All they had was a receipt that you get after the food's been ordered and delivered, you know, after the offer and acceptance has been made. It's a simple receipt. That's certainly not a contract. The banquet contracts we submitted clearly disclaim any intent to benefit a third party. And there's an affidavit attached by the Venetian's general counsel that testifies to the fact that that clause has been in the contract since before 2009. So, I mean, there was, you know, and to determine intent, the court looks at the documents, looks at the contracts, looks at the agreement. What was the agreement? There was no agreement alleged. The agreement was between the Venetian and their customers, not the Venetian, not the employees. What was the agreement? Well, it's our contract, and here it is.
You're calling an agreement, and previously you said that counsel had indicated that there was a contract. So are we to assume that there was a contract, at least between the house, so to speak, and the customer?
There's a contract on the banquet side, which has been produced, and that's the one with the disclaimer. There's no contract in in-suite dining at all. You know, they have to do something to show that their client's the intended beneficiary of some agreement. Nothing was done. And, you know, as Judge Johnson said, the plaintiff has the duty to do more than just make conclusory statements and just speculate. I mean, when you look at the allegations in this case, they're practically libelous, you know, and nothing at all to support them. Just say it, and it's so. It's like Caesar, you know, and that's what the court found. There was absolutely nothing that additional discovery could could provide them. I mean, what are they going to do? They're going to subpoena it. What they want, they don't want discovery. They want some massive fishing expedition so they can subpoena every contract the Venetians ever entered into. That would fill up this room. Are they going to interview every customer the Venetians ever had and said, did you understand that when you saw that service fee on your bill that that was going 100% to the Venetians' employees that served you the food? Was that your understanding? And what if one customer says, oh, yeah, that was my understanding, and 5,000 say, no, it wasn't? I mean, did they make out their case? I mean, what discovery
are they going to do? That's the concern. Not even limited discovery was allowed. So we're not talking about a broad-based, just major fishing expedition into the ocean. We don't even have a fishing expedition into a bucket.
Right, but we provided the banquets contract, and we provided testimony that the contract always had that disclaimer. Even if it didn't have the disclaimer, for the...
Yeah, you make the argument. You talk in terms of a contract. So at least we now have this established. There is some kind of a contract. What the intentions of the parties are, maybe that would have been discerned out of discovery if it had been allowed.
Right, but the intent is discerned by reading the face of the contract. What else are you going to do to determine intent? And even if that disclaimer wasn't in the contract, there is absolutely nothing. The core purpose of an agreement, to make out a case for a third-party beneficiary, you must establish that the core purpose of that agreement was to benefit some third party. Well, there has to be some indication in the agreement, you know, whether just something saying, you know, the purpose of the banquet contract is for the provision and payment of food and beverage. It's certainly the core purpose of the agreement is not to benefit. The Venetian doesn't contract with its customers to benefit its employees so that they can get a tip, even though they are extremely benefited by it. You know, that's not the core purpose of those contracts. What kind of discovery would disabuse that notion?
Is anything that we've done in the Baldonado case with the one tip? Does that affect this at all?
Yes, it does. Yes, absolutely. It has a lot of impact on this case because, number one, Baldonado stood for the premise that an employer can change at will employees' terms and conditions of employment at will. And so if there was ever a policy that 100% of the service charges went to the employees, then the Venetian could change that whenever they wanted to, pursuant to Baldonado. Baldonado also stands for the premise that when there is a proper disclaimer in the handbook preventing the formation of contracts between the employer and the employee, that would prevent any formation of contract. And so they're basically
reading Baldonado a little broadly. Since I authored that, then it was intended to be read. I'm interested in the second argument that was made by counsel as to it dealt with economic enrichment, so to speak, or infringement in that, in terms of he put forth in a
third party claim or
the ability. Of the servers to receive benefits?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
For interference with a prospective.
Oh, okay, so on the willful interference claim.
Yeah.
So, what I haven't been able to get, you know, the plaintiff or the appellant to understand in this case is that the law absolutely requires that to make out a case for wrongful interference with a prospective economic advantage, you must establish that there was some prospective contract. There has to be that. That's in this court ruled that. Let me just get the case. That's this court's law in AmeriCo derivative litigation. That is an element, that is the first element in making out that claim. So, I mean, you can cite restatements, you can find a case that says something different, but that's this court's law. That is an
element.
District
court didn't allow, from my understanding, didn't allow any discovery with regard to whether or not any contracts or alleged contracts existed in the terms of those contracts. Is that correct?
We didn't get to the discovery phase because they couldn't make out a claim and or couldn't raise an issue of material fact.
Let me ask you to switch directions for just a second and have you address the statute of limitations issue for just a moment. From my understanding, the district court judge applied 11-193D as it pertained to fraud and that it must be brought within 3 years. There's another potentially applicable statute, 1192D, which could apply. Tell me why, when you've got two potential applicable statutes, that the more specific statute shouldn't apply, and that the district court erred in that regard. One's a three-year statute of limitation, the other is a four-year.
Mm-hmm. Number one, irrespective of which statute applies, it's run. It's the statute has run, irrespective of whether it's a 3 or 4 year statute. Yeah. So to me, it's a moot issue. I don't even know why it's been so heavily briefed. We argued that the 3 year statute applied because the appellant hasn't shown that she's a victim of consumer fraud. And to state a case under 41600, you must show that you're a victim of consumer fraud. Appellant alleges that the Venetian misled its customers with regard to the character of the service charges and or concealed the fact that 100% of the service charges wasn't being paid to the employees. Well, if that's the case, if that's true, that would be a consumer fraud, but not against the employees, against the customers. So, you have to be a direct victim of consumer fraud to have standing under 41600. And if anything, they're just an incidental victim.
To me, that's somewhat analogous to Baldonado in the sense that the tip wars, assumed that the tip was going to the dealers themselves rather than being shared with pit personnel and other managers.
Right. Well, I mean, it doesn't, from my perspective, it doesn't matter which statute applies because it's run and it has not been told. But, we argued the three-year rule applied because they couldn't get standing as a victim under 41600, and so they had to allege simple fraud, which would be the three-year statute of limitation. If the four-year statute, if the court concludes that there was some deceptive trade practice, as defined under 41600, then we concede the four-year statute.
Counsel, there's some language by the Ninth Circuit, though, that under 41600, victim is not limited to just a consumer.
Right. Right. It's not just a consumer, but they have to have been a victim of the fraud. And the victim of the fraud, as if you accept the facts as alleged by the appellant, was the customer, not the employee. They were just some incidental player in that scenario. Let's see. You don't have to be a customer or a consumer to be a victim, but you do have to be a victim. And they haven't demonstrated that they were a victim. But the statute of limitations on that consumer fraud count is irrelevant. I mean, it's moot. It's clear because the complaint in this matter was filed on November 19th. Let me back up. She was... The appellant was terminated on November 4th, 2008, and the complaint was filed November 9th, 2012, and that's 4 years and 15 days. So it doesn't matter.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Greenberg, you got about a minute and a half left.
Yes, Your Honor. Just to address the issue of the statute of limitations, the district court did correctly apply a toll of 308 days under the American Pipe Doctrine based upon the prior Somos putative class action, which this court has adopted as the law in Nevada on such issues in the Jane Roe Dancer case. In respect to the four-year statute of limitations being applicable, this is a claim against someone who has committed a deceptive trade practice and misrepresentation, and the provision of 11.190 specifically provides 4 years for that kind of claim. The claim is only made actionable under 41600. It is, in fact, a deceptive trade practice claim, or as 11.90 says, against someone who has committed a deceptive trade practice. So there's no reason that the four-year statute of limitations should not apply. In respect to the plaintiff not establishing their status as a victim of the consumer fraud, the essence of this case concerns allegations of misrepresentations or misleading information being given by the Venetian to its customers that economically injured the plaintiff. If the Venetian had expressly told its customers that it was going to have money paid from the customer to the Venetian for the benefit of the plaintiff, that would be a common law bailment. And as the person who is responsible for that bailment, if they didn't pay it over to the plaintiff, they would be subject to suit under the common law. So to say that if the plaintiff can establish factually that the customer understood that this was to happen, that there was to be a payover, so to speak, of these funds to the plaintiff, she is, in fact, the victim of that misrepresentation and misfeasance. My time is up if there are further questions.
Colleagues, any questions?
No.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentations. We appreciate you being here today. This matter will stand submitted.